This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So tonight we're really honored to have Walter Mignolo here with us. So Professor Mignolo is a preeminent scholar working across the humanities, primarily on issues of colonization and decolonization and literature and cultural studies. And so tonight is a conversation about his work and about how we came to this particular text and his future work. And we can sort of cover all of those and then entertain questions from the audience as well. So to get us started, I thought that I could sort of ask you to put this new book in context. And The Darker Side of the Renaissance, The Darker Side of Western Modernity, Local Histories, Global Design, the text that I had mentioned, you very sort of carefully and comprehensively sort of examine these sort of larger global contexts for colonization and decoloniality. This work, I think, is somewhat different because you take a narrower focus, a more direct focus. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what brought you to this particular text at this time.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation and also kind of organizing and coming here. So to briefly kind of answer your question, and then we can amplify or go into the details. When I wrote The Darker Side of the Renaissance, and Beatriz Urraca was the student, graduate student at Michigan at that time, I was trained in philosophy and semiotics to start with. So philosophy in Argentina, and then I went to France to do semiotics, and then came to United States in mid-70s, past century. I was a semiotician, so I was writing about literary theory, discourse analysis, sign system. But in United States, one day I met Luis Dávila, who was directing a journal, Revista Chicano Riqueña. And I said, Luis, ¿qué es eso? ¿Qué es Chicano Riqueño? I have no idea. Through Luis, I began to get into that part of the United States I didn't know, that were the Hispanic, the Chicanos or Chicanas, Latinos, Latinas. I was perceived as Hispanic, because I didn't fit into the kind of Chicano-Chicana imagination. But anyhow, because of the language, because of memories, the kind of the South American, Mexico, South America, etc. So I got in conversation with Chicanos and Chicanas and Puerto Rican. And in the process, those were the years of life in the hyphen. A lot of people are young here, but so I discovered that I was Italo-Argentinian. I have no idea until that time. I was an Argentinian. My grandfather's mother, my ancestor, were Italian. But when you get the awareness that you're Italo-Argentinian, it's because you learn from Ansaldúa, for example, what does it mean to be Chicana, Mexican American, or Asian American, etc. So that slowly took me into trying to understand what was going on. And I began to make the connection, what is going on today in the United States is related to the process of colonization in the 16th century. So I just moved into trying to understand. I didn't talk about coloniality, but colonization meant. And since I was coming from semiotic, I was not trained in political science, I was not trained in economy, I was not trained in geography. So the only possibility I had is to understand the colonization of the imaginary through sign system. So the Dark Crusade of Renaissance is colonization of languages, colonization of memory, kind of narrative, the storytelling of history, and colonization of space, cartography. So that's it. That was the Dark Crusade of the Renaissance. But in 95, so the book was published in 95. So I worked about 10 years in that book. And in 95, I discovered the concept of coloniality that I didn't know, that Quijano had introduced 3 or 4 years before. And when I landed in coloniality, that was an epiphany, because I began to put together things that were just disconnected. So coloniality, discovering the concept of coloniality through Quijano, how he articulated, made me understand that until that moment, people were just talking about modernity. And still a lot of people talk about modernity, and modernity was the totality. But Quijano taught us, they say, well, no, modernity is half of the story. The other half is coloniality. So that's it. I was prepared because I had 10 years of studying colonialism, so it was not difficult to understand that. But not because of academic reason that this you understand coloniality. You understand coloniality because you feel it. You feel something that you didn't know. And you feel, in a different way, of course, and you understand why you were not fitting. I was not fitting in France, I was not fitting in the United States, but I discovered I was not fitting in Argentina. I never felt Argentinian. And it's not because I have anything against the Argentinian. It's because I always have the sensation that I don't belong to this country. This country belongs to the people who have the land, who have been here since 18th century, who kind of build kind of wealth. And I was a son of immigrants. So that is the kind of the emotional. So coloniality put together the kind of the emotional and the rational. So 20 years later, there are a lot of books in between, but 20 years later this, and we can talk a little bit more about that.
So, you know, to follow up on that, I'd like to read a passage from the text and then have you respond, because I think this does touch on, you know, and you know, a lot of let's say post-colonial studies today, the need to differentiate post-colonial from the decolonial, a very important move, and I think this passage gets to sort of the core of what you described. So we'll read it and then have you respond. Okay. So decoloniality denotes a way of thinking, knowing, and being, and doing that began with but also precedes the colonial enterprise and invasion. So we had an email exchange about how we should contextualize this. It implies the recognition of undoing the hierarchical structures of race and gender and heteropatriarchy and class that continue to control life, knowledge, spirituality, and thought, structures that are clearly intertwined with and constitutive of global capitalism and Western modernity. So I think So I think there are two points here: to link decoloniality with thinking and knowing and being and doing. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how you made this connection between the lived experience, the emotional, and then what you described as sort of the academic and the rational.
So first is the distinction between decolonization and decoloniality, as decolonization. But because decolonization, probably it was used before 1950, but it really didn't mean much. But when decolonization really came as a kind of powerful concept was during the Cold War. So you have the Second World, the First World, and what became the Third World. That there is a long story here, but they were trying to be neither capitalist nor communist, but decolonial. What decolonial meant at that time basically was to kick the imperial guys home that were mainly Dutch and French and British. And so the natives or the indigenous people can form, they have their own nation state. So that was the misery and the splendor and the misery of decolonization. As many places, many regions, they build nation state in Asia and Africa. But what happened? The nation state was controlled by the elite of native or indigenous. Fanon saw that. He was in Algeria and he saw what was coming. And he said it in the wretched of the earth. So that is the misery of decolonization. So was a victory and it was a failure at the same time. It was a victory because they sent the colonizer home. But it was a failure because, one, because of the elite, and because then the imperial guys keep on controlling the economy and international politics from London, from Paris, from New York, from Washington, right? So that's the kind of... But at that moment, was another kind of a splendor was the great thinkers on decolonization. Gandhi to start, at the beginning of the 50s or the 40s. Gandhi, Césaire, Fanon, Lumumba, Cabral, Biko, they left a really powerful archive of decolonial thinking. So, that is during the Cold War. When Quijano introduced coloniality, introduced decoloniality, in the sense that coloniality is a decolonial concept. It's not a concept in any of the discipline, of the kind of economy or political science or philosophy, because all those disciplines come from European way of thinking and needs. Right? So it's very difficult to feel coloniality in Europe. You feel modernity in Europe, you don't feel coloniality. But if you are in the Andes, you feel coloniality. And then when we start talking about coloniality, and I find people from the Middle East, from India, from sector of China, Africa, of course. We have different memories, different stories, histories, but we understand what we're talking about. Because it's not a conceptual understanding of coloniality. It's an emotional understanding. Yeah? And on the other side, it's more difficult to understand for a white person, man or woman, and especially if he's on top heterosexual. Why is it difficult? Because it's difficult, they don't feel it. So they have to understand first rationally. And then trying to understand, if you are a white woman, well, you begin to understand you are a woman, even if you are white. You know? But the power of coloniality is a concept that emerged to respond to the need of the third world. And that's fine. Because, when I went to study in France, I had to make a lot of effort to understand rationally and emotionally those concepts that the French were doing, were using. Yeah? So Derrida, Foucault, they were, gee, yeah, very brilliant thinker, but were not kind of my people. I mean, emotionally was not the same kind of relation like I can have when I read Fanon or Césaire or Vico or Cabral, even if I am not African or I am not black, but the question of how we experience colonialism, even in Argentina. And as I said before, as a son of an immigrant, that was the first personal experience. And the second personal experience is somebody from the third world that goes to France at the moment in which, in the mid-70s, the boom of Latin American novel was in the air. So we were looked at in France as les derniers gagés d'outre-mer. They were kind of the curious indigenous who have the Latin American novel as a kind of as the culture. No? So being from the third world and being immigrant is my kind of experience of feeling of coloniality. You know? So that's one thing. Decolonization during the Cold War, the introduction of coloniality in the 90s, when the failure of the Cold War, of the decolonization was obvious. So the question that this book addressed, what does it mean to decolonize in the 90s and in the 21st century? We are no longer in the Cold War. We are not in a Cold War. People talk about a new Cold War. We can talk about that. But so that's one thing. The second thing should mention is that the difference with post-colonialism. One way to understand this as a kind of pedagogical example, as a metaphor, you see, Catholic and Protestant are both Christians. And I'm trying to make an analogy, who is Protestant, who is Catholic. You see, they are both Christians, but they don't get together very, very well. Yeah? They have some problems. So post-colonial, decolonial, we have colonialism in common. But we have other differences. It's not just to fight, it's just to make a clear distinction. Post-colonialism, there is no post-colonialism until 1982 or 81. Why? Because there is no postmodernity before 78, that Lyotard published The Postmodern Condition. And postcolonialism piggyback. A friend of mine said, don't say piggyback, they said, say something else. But it's piggybacking into postmodernity, right? What postcolonialists introduced was very important, the colonial question. Postmodern thinker, because they were European, and they find that they had to do. It's not a sin to be European. I mean, they didn't decide to. They just happened to be born there and address the question. So the question of colonialism for postmodern or all the 60s and the 70s, Sartre perhaps is the one, but he was not postmodern, he was existentialist. So that is the question. Post-colonialists emerged in the early 80s. And piggyback, when I say piggyback, have four kind of apocalyptic horses, right? Spivak Derrida, Baba Lacan, Said Foucault, and the subaltern studies Gramsci. And that is why it's easy to read. Not that the Homi Bhabha or Spivak are easy to read, but they're easier to read for a European because they have a reference. They have Foucault, or they have Derrida, or they have Gramsci, or they have that. So this is the genealogy. So you won't see post-colonial thinker that kind of go into their own genealogy of the memories of their own kind of languages or country. They are post-colonial next to the post-modern. For the decoloniality has a different genealogy of thought. One thing first. Post-colonial come mainly from the historical experience of decolonization in India. Plus Said, who become post-colonial après la lettre, no, avant la lettre. Because Said published Orientalism in 78, and in 78 were not yet post-colonial. The book I really like is Said. I mean, I like all the books, but my preferred book is The Palestine Question. And no post-colonial read The Palestine Question. And all the colonial read The Palestine Question. Because it's in The Palestine Question where Said is next to Césaire, next to Fanon, next to Memmi. So he's kind of a thinker who is thinking the colonial condition in Palestine. Right? So the genealogy of thought of decolonial thinking, there are two. One is the Bandung Conference, 1955. It's in the Bandung Conference where the kind of the idea neither communism nor capitalism but decolonization emerged with all the problem I mentioned before. So when Quijano introduced coloniality, he was aware of that, but he has another genealogy of thought, which is Peruvian genealogy of thought. Was José Carlos Mariátegui, the same generation than Gramsci, a few years difference. José Carlos Mariátegui was, he died also very, very young. I mean, he died at 28, something like that, but he left a tremendous. So he was a Marxist and he was a mestizo, but he was very aware of the Indian question and the question of the land. So in José Carlos Mariátegui, there is already a seed, and Quijano comes from there, right? Okay, so that's the puyelechon. And now to address this specific question. So you see, once you realize that decolonization, one of the goals of decolonization was to have your own nation state, and you realize that nation state is not the solution, it's a problem, you don't want to keep on trying to form your own state or trying to grab some kind of state already formed. I mean, it doesn't work. I mean, you see what happened to Cuba, see what happened in Venezuela with Chavez and all that, and that is kind of. So what is the role of the coloniality today? What the colonial thinkers want? And by the colonial thinker, I mean the colonial activist and the colonial artist, and because to be an activist, you have to think. Right? And to be an artist, you have to think. I mean, whatever you do, you have to think. But when you are aware of the coloniality, you can begin to think in a specific way. So today, for us, when I say us, is that kind of the think tank, the small group that emerged out of Quijano, that we are recognized as the modernity, coloniality, the coloniality project or whatever. No? So there are two, and that is what we explain in this book. One is the analytic of coloniality, the decolonial analytic. So of what? What do you analyze when we say that? What do you analyze? And I, I think this, I will give you a kind of pedagogical example. Only pedagogical, nothing else, right? So we had to cure and health. If you look at what Freud did, or what Lacan did, they spend their life trying to understand the unconscious, right? I was telling them, if you ask Freud in a given moment, let's say 1900, what are you working on? Freud would say the unconscious. And then you ask again 1920, what are you working on? The unconscious. So will Lacan. Yeah? Lacan work on the unconscious. But you see, there's a lot of things there. So for us, the unconscious is what we call the colonial matrix of power, the CMP. Pedagogically, I will say, just pedagogical, that the colonial matrix of power is the underlying structure of Western civilization. This is a very heavy statement, but let me qualify a little bit. There is no Western civilization until the Renaissance. Greece and Rome are Western civilization after the Renaissance. The Greeks, they were looking at Egypt and they were looking at the Persian. They had the back to the West. There was nothing there. What then about Rome? But Rome, yeah, where is that the Roman Empire joined Christianity? Not in Rome, in Istanbul. So is the institutionalization of Christianity, that kind of long period, the Middle Ages, is the Renaissance who began to build itself at the image of become Western civilization. And the image of Western civilization coincide, let's just begin before, in 15th century, 14th century, but is consolidated with colonial expansion. Because it's the difference with the exteriority that affirms the interiority of Western civilization. Is that Western civilization began to build walls all over, right? Kind of in order to define your identity, you have to create the difference in relation to which your identity is defined. And if you are in power, the difference is always pagans, barbarian, communist, black, yellow, Chinese, etc., etc. So it's a kind of the constant building. So that is what we study. How the colonial matrix of power emerged, how it's being transformed from the 1500 to today, what happened with China, what happened in Venezuela, what happened in Syria, what happened in the United States in relation to Russia. We understand that because we understand it through the history, not the history of the West, the history of the colonial matrix of power. So we are a peculiar kind of historian. We do history to understand the colonial matrix of power, right? And I give you another example, pedagogical example, a really kind of parallel with psychoanalysis. See, the psychoanalysts, they think, they kind of constantly process trying to understand the unconscious and all the kind of the derivations of the unconscious. But when they are practitioner, when they have analysis, people who analyze with them, they do two things. They listen to the story, because each story is singular. There is no. But at the same time, they are paying attention. What is that story is telling me about the unconscious, and what the unconscious that I know theoretically is telling me about that story. So it's a similar way of thinking. When we study a specific configuration, historical, economic, etc., we are trying to understand there how the colonial matrix of power is working, and at the same time, how the colonial matrix of power is helping me to understand what happened today in Venezuela, for example, right? So that's the analytic. Then the question is, the analytic, why do we need the analytic? Because one of the key points of decolonial politics is the linking. The linking from what? From the colonial matrix of power. But to the link from the colonial matrix of power, you have to know, not in abstract, how the colonial matrix of power works, how the colonial matrix of power works on you. So there is no distinction between subject and object. So I said before, I mean, the question of the emotional, I mean, think about trying to feel first how the colonial matrix of power is controlling you. And then you analyze, let's say, scholarly or analytically or rational or whatever. But the question is the link. And the linking is dependent on who you are and what you are. Who you are as a person, but also who you are as a professional, or who you are as a kind of social activist in the community. So there is no blueprint for the coloniality. And this is very important. Why? Because the colonial matrix of power, or modernity for short, even if there are different positions and different opinions in science, physics, biology, economy, political science, etc., they all have something in common, which is the basic assumption that are in the foundation of Western knowledge, right? That is a kind of control diversity. That is a control diversity that first was put in place by theology, Christian theology, Western Christian theology, Catholic and Protestant. And with secularization, the structure remained. It's just they got God out of the way and put reason and the men in the center. Men, not human beings, human men. So that structure, the colonial matrix of power, began to expand all over the world, but connected with total a diversity of local histories, languages, memories, way of being, way of being in the world. So today the decolonial is coming from all that kind of diversity that the colonial matrix of power somehow generated in the process of trying to control, right? So the decolonial is one response, not the only one, is one response to the expansion of Western civilization, or more abstractly, the expansion of the colonial matrix of power. So in that sense, decoloniality is a way of being in the world. It's not the scholarly, we can do a scholarly work too, but that is not the purpose. The purpose is not to increase the curriculum. The purpose is not to kind of debunk the previous theory so I can affirm mine. The purpose is to understand who control us, to build a different way of being in the world, not just by yourself, with other people. So rebuilding the communal, whatever you understand the communal. So not the common Marxist, not the common good liberal, not the kind of the community of Christianity. the communal, the decolonial communal comes from a different kind of analytic. Because if you look at what the liberal proposed, let's leave the neoliberal away, trying to understand. What liberalists proposed, the good, honest liberal, right? The good intention liberal. What they propose is based on their own assumption and analytics, right? They have their own analysis through the social science or through philosophy or through justice or law, etc. What Marxists propose is based on the analysis of capitalism. What Christianity proposes as a solution, as a kind of, is based on Christian view of the world. So what we propose, rebuilding the communal, living together in a different, in a decolonial way, being sensing, comes from the linking from the colonial matrix of power and relinking with what? And now that depends. If you are an indigenous Native America or First Nation of Canada, you have, and they have, a very specific way they know what they want to relink with. Give me the land. The land is spirituality. The land is pedagogy. The land is rebuilding our communal, that kind of colonization destroyed. If you are an African or an Afro-American, and you correct me, but if you are an Afro-American, well, your marking point is the middle passage. You have that wound in your body, in your memory, in your spirit. So you have to begin to relink with that memory. And it's already, voodoo, Santeria, Voodoo, Santeria, Rastafarian, Candomblé, there are all kind of building the communal of the runaway slaves. So in Africa, I leave Gabriel say more, but in Africa, if you are an African, you have two moments. One is that Africa was depleted from the slave trade in the 16th, 17th century. And then you have another moment, which is 1884, when all the African countries are controlled by European countries. So, and destroying the communal. So, relinking with what? With a way of life that has been dismantled, the value, etc. No? And I finish with this. And we, the white people, what do? Right? Well, in Latin America now, there is a kind of concept and debate that come from the indigenous people, but it's being embraced by non-indigenous as well, working together, which is summa causae. So summa causae is translated as to live well and not to live better. And to live well means to live in harmony, to live in plenitude. To recover, if there is something to recover, life. Because the colonial matrix of power is a machine of producing death and separation and destruction. So that is a way of being, doing, thinking, all kind of together into that orientation.
This is what I love about Walter's work. That was just one sentence from the introduction that he explicated for us. So, Gabriel?
Well, I want to get back to Victor's initial question about journeys, your journey to decoloniality. But I want to ask about the journey of this particular book. The way it was constructed, you and your co-author, Catherine Walsh, decided on a specific construction for this book, part one, introduction, part one, part two, a conclusion, and an afterword on this topic of decoloniality. I was wondering whether you had specific reasons for that kind of structure, or was it dictated by certain circumstances?
Well, there are kind of practical questions. Because first we proposed to Duke Press a book series. Actually, we didn't propose. Was Gisela Fossado, an editor of Duke, who suggested. But she suggested to me because Catherine lives in Ecuador. Said, Walter, why don't we do a book series on decoloniality? And I said, well, that's a good idea, but I think it would be better if we have another person could be Catherine Walsh, because she works a lot in Latin America. So we are kind of inverted here. She is a gringa in Ecuador. I am an Argentinian in the United States. So that was a very nice kind of articulation, right? And so we made the proposal, and one of the reviewers suggested that Kathy and I write the first book, so people will know what the series is about, and we have a kind of frame. And then come your question. So how do we write? I have been working with Catherine for 20 years, so we know each other quite well, and we collaborate in her PhD in Ecuador. And through the year, with the group, always doing something. So it was very easy to know. I knew what she would write about, and I know what I would write about, of course. When we start talking about, it was not going to work to do one text with four hands. And we decided that she will do her part and I will do my part. We wrote the introduction together, and we have a dialogue at the end together. So the book kind of got this kind of flexibility also, a kind of composition of two parts, introduction in common, a dialogue at the end. And it worked very well. It worked very well because we have our kind of autonomy in writing. And because we have been working, not just Catherine and I, but with the group, we know what we're talking about. So we exchange ideas and questions during the process. But we wrote it independently.
And somewhere, I think in your part, you talk about the importance of the enunciator to set the parameters and enunciation. Mm-hmm. So it takes us into language and the importance of language. And I'm interested in translation. And I was wondering whether you have something to say about the place of language as we try to transfer knowledge, because knowledge is an important part of the decolonial project.
I have something to say about that, yeah. Yeah. Well, you said the enunciation, you said languaging?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so let's say what languaging means, and then we go into translation. Languaging is a concept that comes from a Chilean neurophysiologist, Humberto Maturana, which since the 70s, I didn't mention that, when I was a semiotician, Maturana was already someone I was paying a lot of attention. As a matter of fact, in The Darker Side of the Renaissance, mm-hmm. I refer the first chapter of The Darker Side of the Renaissance is titled Describing Ourselves, Describing Ourselves. That is totally Maturana move. because Maturana has been insisting that there is no reality over there, there is not objectivity over there. Reality and objectivity, said Maturana, are arguments to convince. Because when somebody tells you, come on, be realistic, or somebody tells you, hey, come on, be objective, he or she is telling, think like me, right? So that is reality and objectivity. So Maturana said there is nothing with, is the observer, as a concept he uses, who kind of articulates what it is. So that, and that goes to the Annunciation. So everything I wrote since the Renaissance, the darkest of the Renaissance, was always aware the Annunciation is at the center. Kind of the awareness that you are not describing something that exists there independent of you, but what you are describing is also describing yourself. You talk about yourself when you talk about something else, right? So that's a kind of describing ourselves. In that regard, so Maturana kind of doesn't talk about language as all the kind of Saussure and Chomsky to start in the 20th century. All the kind of the linguistic science that reduce language into kind of statistics and science and square. So no, there is no, I said, what we have is languaging. So he converts a noun into a verb. We language, right? That is related to a larger theory of Maturana, which is the origin of humanness. I won't go there. But the question is that languaging is something we do, and what we do is conversation. And conversation is not communication. It's not transmitting information. Because if you pay attention, in Western scholarship, since the 50s, everything is information and communication. From biology to physics to linguistics to the Department of Communication. And that comes from cybernetics. It is cybernetics, and one of the derivations of cybernetics that is, I think, was von Neumann, a theory of, von Neumann was a game theory. And then there was a theory, Shannon. Shannon was a kind of information, a theory of information, something like that. So everything is bit. But bit, kind of communication, kind of detach you from languaging, right? You convert language in something, an object there. Pieces of information. You communicate. Yeah? You iPod.
Transmit.
Languaging is conversation, not communication. And conversation is coordination of behavior. And that is the communal. We have to converse, right? But communication kind of cut into the human relations. And then we go into the question of machine and all these kind of things. But we have to think about that. Maybe better that we don't converse anymore, or just converse less and less, or not. I am not making a judgment here. I'm just saying what cybernetics and technology, the technological revolution of the 60s and the technological revolution of the 21st century, well, the 60s goes, kind of breaking up. We feel good by ourselves. We are in the park with the iPod and kind of listening to music or whatever, no? But not paying attention to people. The park is empty. So languaging means And that is part of rebuilding the communal. Rebuilding language and conversation, interaction, etc., etc. Okay, that's fine. Translation. Translation for us, and when I say us, the people who just always and only look at the colonial mix of power. So translation is a fundamental component in the foundation, the historical foundation of the colonial mix of power in the 16th century. But it continues until today. How does it work? What the missionaries translated in the 16th century? They translated Nahuatl or Aymara or some of the Mayan languages or Chiquitanos, etc., to Spanish or to Latin. They translate some Spanish into Aymara, into Maya language. And the question is not the incommensurability of meaning. The problem is the power differential. When they translated from Nahuatl to Spanish, is to tell the Spanish what we have to do to control the Nahuatl. And when they translated Spanish or Latin into Nahuatl, they say, this is what you have to learn. Forget about your story. And that, if we jump to today, during the Cold War, to make it simple, what did you translate from the First World to the Third World? You translate science or philosophy. What do you translate from the Third World to the First World? Culture, right? You translate kind of curious ethnological information. At that point, you could translate, there was translation and a lot of people interested in Mandarin because of all the kind of the difference and the Confucianism, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very easy then maintain the power differential. And if the translation was from Chinese to German, well, it was the same. I mean, there was something that the German needed to translate. So the power differential is across every kind of translation in the colonial matrix of power, except that you translate from France, from French to German, or German to English. That is just within the family. Yeah? Maybe some kind of small family feud, but it's not a big deal. But when you have to translate Arabic to German, or German to Arabic, that is
Come back to, I have some more passages, but there are a lot of sentences. But I would like to come back to the first one that I read. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the colonial matrix of power. I think that as a critical concept, not just in this book, but in your other writings. And I wonder if you could describe that a little bit more in terms of the delinking. I think there are ways to look at that are kind of maybe easy to do, easy delinking in terms of just maybe, you know, correcting history. But there are other more fundamental ways to delink. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the spectrum of delinking as it relates to the cultural matrix of power, colonial matrix of power.
Yeah, we don't have a blackboard or a PowerPoint. No, but use your visual imagination. So the colonial matrix of power, it is easy to describe also. And it's better because it's more flexible. You can imagine more. If you have a diagram there, you are kind of constrained. So the colonial matrix of power, as we described, it has four domains. I will simplify that. The domain of knowledge and understanding, and there is a reason why I put knowledge and understanding first, I mean mention, certain point. There is a domain of authority or governance, any kind of governance, not just the nation state, the monarchic state, the Chinese dynasty, the Shahanate, the Incanate, I mean, every kind of complex human communities need some kind of organization. So then another domain, and we put it 1, 2, 3, 4, not in line, but kind of distributed like that in a space, is the domain of the economy. Not capitalism yet, oikonomi, oikos, but also IU in the Andes, the household, the kind of the administration of life. And then the domain of the human, the man human. Yeah? So those are the four domains. But those four domains are at one level. There is another level that we put at the center, which is the level of the enunciation. So the four domains are the content, what is being enunciated. And people ask, how do you decide those domains? Because we study what we call the rhetoric of modernity. The rhetoric of modernity is a bunch of discourse that self-define. And for modernity, those are the four, four key domains. So we get it, how the colonial means of power build itself, so we are kind of, yeah. So, and then we have the enunciation. And the enunciation is invisible. That is why Western knowledge emphasizes objectivity, because they hide the enunciation. Right? That was the big triumph. And for us, the analytic is a, hey, come on, get the mask off. I want to kind of look at your enunciation, how you do to build those domains and control it, transform, but also manage. So the enunciation, what is the enunciation? The enunciation is built, this is the analytic of colonial measure of power. We have to, the unconscious is not something that is in our head. The unconscious is something that Freud kind of built in to kind of understand human psyche, right? So the enunciation is formed by three different complementary agencies, let's put it that way. One is institutions. Two of the fundamental institutions of the formation of the colonial matrix of power are the university and the museum. Right? The Renaissance University, but everything that derived from that. I mean, the formation of the science, physical science, astronomy, etc., etc. All that comes from this institution. And the museum is more a kind of educational, but this kind of concentration. And it's very interesting, the museum, because there is a story there. If you go to the Museum of Natural History of New York, you will find beautiful Chinese scroll. If you go to the Museum of Natural History of Chicago, you will have Aztec manuscript. So, and then you have the Museum of Modern or Contemporary Art. So the Museum of Modern Contemporary Art are Western civilization. The other civilization goes to the Museum of Natural History, something like that. And you don't notice that until you begin to make analyze how the colonial matrix of power is formed, right? So, institution. university museum and government. The monarchic state, then the bourgeois national state, and the papacy. Those are the kind of fundamental institutions that control knowledge, form and control knowledge. So, institution. Second, the institutions are not yet, were not yet robotic, that kind of function by themselves. They need actors. So there is a correlation between the actors and the institution. The actors created the institution to serve the need of the actors and the community, the interest that they represent, right? Well, it so happened that if you look, it's not very difficult to see that this institution, since the Renaissance, when were formed and then maintained, were built by white men, and they were Christians, and they were European. And they were, at least they say, they were heterosexual. If they were not, they just passed. Right. So whiteness is embedded in the institutional and actantial, because not everybody goes to occupy position there. You have to be trained. That's why you have the papacy. That's why you have Harvard. That's why you have the museum. So you have to train the people to kind of reproduce. No? And the third component, and that goes to your language. In this sense, not languaging, but language in the sense of modern. And the knowledge controlled by the form and controlled by this enunciation of Western civilization, are six modern European imperial languages. Portuguese, Italian, the Renaissance. Portuguese and Spanish. I mean, Portugal and Spain controlled the world until the late 17th century. They were the master, right? The British and the French and the Dutch were kind of jealous people trying to take power and send in the pirates of the Caribbean to kind of destroy the... So six, and then after the Enlightenment, French, English and German kind of began to take over, and the other three are the south of Europe, which is very important today in the European Union, right? The south of Europe and the... So those six languages have two foundations, Greek and Latin. That's it. The Mandarin and Urdu and Swahili and Bambara and Arabic and Russian are second class language. So when you translate, you have to kind of... So we have domain, and then we go to have the link. We have the domain and we have the levels of enunciation. Now, two more things. The flows, because those domains and the levels are not separated. There are flows that connect those domains and flows that connect the enunciation. So to understand the colonial matrix of power, you have to have this kind of holistic structure. But modernity, trying to deviate from that, because modernity or post-modernity or whatever, created the figure of the expert. The expert knows a little bit about a small thing and is an ignorant about how these things work in the larger machine. So there are flows. So you study, and that means that you cannot understand economy without understanding the relation economy with humanity and race and authority and knowledge and the enunciation. You cannot understand gender sexuality without understanding how it relates to the economy, to authority, how it relates to the enunciation. Yeah? So there are kind of the flows. And the question now, the link. We cannot delink two things. We cannot delink all at once, because with a link in relation to who you are, as I said at the beginning. The people, if you are an artist, for example, or a curator and work in the museum, well, you will concentrate on that is your everyday life. And then you are a person, and you can be a white, you can be a yellow, you can be a gay, you can be a whatever. So you had kind of began to organize how the link from the heteronormativity, if I am a lesbian or gay or etc., and how I the link from the control, the aesthetic control, and the concept of art that we that has been imposed through the university and knowledge on us. So the colonial artists today are working on that. And for example, this is jumping into already your question, what did the colonial artists want? Well, first, people say, well, yeah, I'm not an artist. I mean, this is a concept I cannot relate. I do things. For example, Benvenuto Cavajai. I just read an article with, not about him, but from his work. Benvenuto Cavajai is, as he say, he is an artisto mayo. For those of you who don't understand Spanish, artista is A, and maya is A in Spanish. But he doesn't say artista maya, he does say artisto mayo. And he uses that because in his family, a Maya speaker have difficulty in pronouncing the A. And when they pronounce the A, it's like an O. So that is a way he uses to say yes, but no. Mm-hmm. And then he said, "What for us, what they call art, this is always related to spirituality. It's related to the sacred. And, he said, for us, for me, doing art, doing this kind of thing, doing things, is healing the colonial wound. So then is how the colonial wound emerged in the vocabulary of the colonial aesthetic thesis. What the colonial matrix of power does is inflict wound in a lot of people. Inflict wounds in people who do not fit the model of the person, of the human. And that's what I was talking about at the beginning. You feel it. And if you don't feel it, and it's not your fault, you cannot avoid now to be aware that there is a lot of people who do feel it. And I will say that two-thirds of the world or more feel it. And if you don't feel it, it's because you have been educated in it. But again, it's not your fault, but you cannot ignore it. But I mean, that is your responsibility, that is your ethic. Huh? You can block it. So the question is, you began to the link from a specific who you are as a person and in what kind of social sphere you act. But in every case, the target is the enunciation. We have to delink from the enunciation because it's knowledge who control us. So we have to begin to build a different kind of knowledge, not just the analytic, but also the building. And well, there is a lot of things going on. No? I mean, when you read Beacon, when you read Fanon with this kind of perspective, they were already doing it. They were delinking already from the colonial matrix of power. There was not this kind of analysis at that time. But the way they were thinking a black person trained at the university, but building their own conceptual structure, where? In the borderland. That is where border dwelling and border thinking come into the picture. Why? Because if you don't belong to the model of the colonial matrix of power, you have been placed in exteriority. Not in the outside, exteriority. Why? Because exteriority, you have to be related to the inside in order to be controlled. If you are outside, well, you cannot be controlled. So the exteriority is built in the process of building the interiority of the colonial matrix of power. So, for example, there is no barbarian and there is no terrorist. Civilization and terrorism are two Western concepts, right? And in order to save and promote civilization, you have to create the exteriority. Be the barbarian, be the communist, be the gay, the lesbian, the terrorist, etc. I'm not saying that there are not people who put in bomb and all that, but the question I am questioning is the concept of terrorism and how this articulated to maintain the control of knowledge in Western civilization. So that is the, what we are trying to do.
Well, I have one more thing. Do we have time for? Or?
And then we'll turn it over to questions.
Okay, one more thing. So the idea of knowledge has come up a lot in the part of the book that you wrote. I have a short quote here, and I'll ask a question from the book. It says, quote, "The task of decoloniality after decolonization is redefined and focused on epistemology and knowledge rather than the state." You've talked about delinking and then relinking with something different. And I'm wondering what you would have for us teachers, professors, community activists, students, civic activists are out there. What kind of suggestion or maybe words you would have for ways in which individuals and communities can relink?
Okay. Well, first, if you are activist but you do not question your assumption and the kind of goals you have, you may be an activist that is work within the colonial matrix of power. And that is not necessarily bad. But I won't say that this is the decolonial. So, for example, to be anti-racist or kind of confront racism, you don't have to be decolonial. There is many ways of doing it. So, let me put it this way. As teacher of activists, for me, the first, I work with a lot of activists in the sense, and for example, in Argentina, I mean, with people in the radio. When they took the factories after the crisis of 2000, so they formed radios, they created radio, there are many radio, the kind of neighborhood, barrios, there are schools. But there is also in the middle of the city a lot of young people who kind of rent a house and create a cultural center. And the cultural center is to kind of do politics. I mean, not paint walls, but they do kind of cultural politics. So I'm working with them because the question is, to think decolonially in order to do decolonial activism. Because you can do activism in trying to, this is important, trying to change the content. You're trying to change the content of one of the domains, or trying to change the content of one of the articulation of the enunciation. But the decolonial task is, and that's important. It's not that it's not, but the decolonial task is not to change the content, is to change the term of the conversation. Because if you change the content, the colonial matrix of power control the term of the conversation. They let you critique, but within the rules and the assumption that they can control. So the question here, that the linking is precisely to the link from, and that for me is already doing, that is for me already activism. It's not just abstract thinking. You put your body and your emotion into trying to find out a way, with dignified anger, as the Zapatistas would say, to get out of this machine that forces you to think in a certain way. And I say, I don't want to think that way because I don't feel it. So that is, the body goes there. Mm-hmm. But also when you do it together with other people, well, it's much better. So that is anecdotal. But the question is, when Quijano introduced decoloniality as analytic, the colonial matrix of power, then at the end, he said, decolonization, he was using decolonization at that time, now we say decoloniality, or decolonialization as decoloniality, no, at the end. Decolonization as epistemic reconstitution. This is what decoloniality became for us after Quijano. For indigenous people it's different, for an Afro it's different, for a kind of a Muslim, decolonial Muslim is different. But for us, it's epistemic reconstitution. And epistemic reconstitution is to kind of the link from modern epistemology and postmodern epistemology, and began to build and live decolonially. And live decolonially means that you are creating a way of thinking and a way of being that is no longer, as Groucho Marx would say, I don't want to be a member of a society that wants me to be a member. So I don't want to be a member of modernity that wants me to be a member. Right? I am in conversation in Canada or in Bolivia or in Ecuador or in Guatemala. They don't want to go back to the past because the past is here in the present, it's with them. There is something that was never gone, but was always marginalized, and they kind of lost confidence in that way of being. So what they are doing, they are kind of, as the Canadian will say, re-emerge. And that is rebuilding their communal. For example, feminismo comunitario. Communitarian feminism that is big in Guatemala and Bolivia. So the feminism is based on the memories and the cosmology of the Mayas and the Incas. And the question here is, if you go back to Greece, nobody said, oh, come on, you cannot go back to the past. How can you go back to Greece and Rome? Nobody asked that question. But if you want to go back to Mecca and Medina, not go back, but if you want to kind of revive Mecca and Medina, or you want to revive Tawantinsuyo because it's here, and Mecca and Medina is here, and Islam is here, you are going back to the past. That is the privilege of Western civilization, that the past of Western civilization is constitutive of the present. But that is prohibited to everybody else. So that is the question. That is the question. So for indigenous people, the question is to what they want to preserve. And they want to preserve, I'm not indigenous, as I said, but what I learned from what I hear, they want to preserve the way of thinking, the way of living, because they don't want to just live and think as the state, the settlers, as we talked with the compañera there, want them. So that is the rebuilding. The rebuilding is rebuilding something that was never gone, but has been kind of destroyed and dismantled and kind of fractured. Yeah? Now, if you don't have that need, you may ask, how can you do that? But the people who have the need, they know how to do it, because they know it. They have to. They have that thing to rebuild, to become what modernity taught them to despise in order to become civilized. So that is the first point. Let me address the other point. We don't talk about capitalism, we talk about economic coloniality. A couple of reasons there. For example, liberal and Marxist talk about capitalism. Weber talk about capitalism, Lenin talk about capitalism. Liberal like capitalism, neoliberal also. Marxists don't like capitalism, but they believe that there is something called capitalism. That's fine, that's a theory. For us, what liberal and Marxist call capitalism is fundamental in the historical foundation of the colonial matrix of power. I give you four examples. Massive appropriation of land, massive exploitation of labor and slavery, slave trade. To do what? To produce commodity for a global market because the ships were for the first time going. And the fourth, it's the first time in the history of the humankind, of the human species, that life became dispensable or disposable. Tell the story, there is a ship coming from Africa. The enslaved human being got sick, and they throw it to the ocean. Because if you take it to land, you have to pay insurance, you have to take care, so you lose a lot of money. So life becomes dispensable from the 16th century to today. That is the work of the colonial matrix of power. So Marxists study capitalism. We study the colonial matrix of power and how the economy that the Marxists call capitalism is part of that. And one more thing, until 1945, what you call capitalism was part of society, was an important part of society, was part of society. Since 1945-60 and today, society became part of capitalism or the economic coloniality. So we study the whole kind of configuration, economy in relation to the state, in relation to knowledge, in relation to enunciation, etc. And we have dialogue with the Marxists, but for example, Marxists, there are exceptions now, some women, but Marxists never address the question of gender, sexuality, and race. For us, it's fundamental. And Lewis Gordon, a Jamaican philosopher, said, the Americas smells like race. Europe smells like class. But racism is the foundation of what you call capitalism. But Marxists won't accept that. Because for Marxist capitalism is industrial revolution as a proletarian is not the kind of the racialized, enslaved people, Indians, and then. So, but we have to understand that there are two different stories, two different theories. So, remember, depend on the observer. So what you call capitalist, you cannot expect that everybody who is not within the frame of Marxist will have to accept capitalism. We address the economic question, of course, it's fundamental, but we have a different narrative. Capitalism is the language of the colonial matrix of power. As I said, I mean, Weber talked about capitalism, and Lenin talked about capitalism. That is the rhetoric of modernity. In favor, to promote, or critical. Because modernity comes from the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the kind of the colonial matrix of power. We step out and look how these people kind of organize the game.